Well, good morning. Let's go ahead and start and our lesson in Proverbs 5. Today, I do intend to cover the whole chapter. Let's begin with a reading of Proverbs 5. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion, and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life. Her ways are unstable. You do not know them. Therefore, hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house. Lest you give your honor to others, and your years to the cruel one. Lest aliens be filled with your wealth, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. And you mourn at last when your flesh and body are consumed, and say, how I have hated instruction, and my heart despised correction. I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray. So, let's go back here. This slide does not represent where the divisions are at. I'll show you how we're going to divide this chapter in just a moment. But let's take a look at the word clouds. So, I don't think there is much that's interesting about this cloud. It looks fairly normal with what you'd expect to find. And being a prominent you, your, my, her. You read the chapter, I think you get that idea. I took out a few other words. I removed and. I think I removed something else, but I don't remember what it is. And it didn't change much, but lest, a little more often. You, my, your, her, be. So I didn't think the word cloud was terribly revealing with this chapter in terms of what the subject matter looks like, but it is an interesting one. This chapter is really divided into two sections. The first section begins in verse 1. My son, pay attention to my wisdom, lend your ear to my understanding. And that runs all the way through verse 6. And then in verse 7, the second section starts, therefore hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. These two sections are the main ones. They both open with an address to the audience. Who is it? Is it my son, my children? And the general instruction about participating in the learning of understanding and such. But then verse 15, the instruction shifts. Between 7 and 14, he has some specific ideas and a pattern in mind. And then 15, he shifts. And then in 21, he shifts again. But it appears that most folks consider the major sections to be 1 and 7. And so as you read this chapter on your own, that's the idea behind it. All right, so let's take a look at how he breaks this chapter down. Well, before we do that, let me ask you a question. What what were the two significant thoughts of the end of chapter 4? There was an example of that Solomon used to help us remember things. He was describing lots of different items that belonged to this set. I had a figure representing that step. Do you guys remember what that illustration? I found it helpful to think about that illustration, anatomy. He ended chapter 4 with a discussion on anatomy. He, in verse 20, let incline your ear. Here he's saying, lend me your ear. Departing from your eyes, in the midst of your heart, keeping your heart with diligence, that your eyes look straight ahead. And there's also in verse 26 this reminder that we're to ponder things, we're to think about them and order them, in verse 26. So I think this is an example of where Proverbs picks up, where the previous chapter left off. The chapter divisions are somewhat arbitrary, but I think here it's a good division, but we shouldn't distance ourselves too far from the previous one. And I'll show you how that plays as we move along today. But keep that in mind, the anatomy and the pondering. So one of the first instructions after this introduction, the introduction has an instruction, lend your ear. So in other times, the idea is inclining your ear. And now he's saying to lend your ear to my understanding. Give it to my understanding for a moment. And verse 2, the reason given for this is that we can preserve discretion. Why do we need to preserve discretion? And discretion is an interesting word. I hope it comes to mind. We've looked at it at least once before in Proverbs. But in our usage today, you'll most likely encounter the word discretion in either behaving or speaking in such a way as to avoid unnecessary offense. He was used his discretion in describing the situation. You didn't want to make things unduly offensive, or perhaps you didn't want to reveal any sensitive information about a person. That's the first way we use discretion. Or two, having the freedom or the prerogative in deciding what kinds of action should be taken in a particular situation. So the district attorney used his discretion in pursuing the bandits or something along those lines. But that's not really what Proverbs has in mind. That's how we tend to think of discretion. That's not the way Proverbs is looking at this. We first encountered this word in the opening of Proverbs, in the introduction area where Solomon tells us what the purpose of this chapter is when we get to verses 2 through 6. And in Proverbs 1:4, we see the importance of discretion. Solomon writes in this dedication and this purpose that his hope is that the young man, in studying Proverbs, will give the young man knowledge and discretion. And the idea here is discretion is the ability to form plans, to act resourcefully, to possess insight, to be able to scheme, and to have the ability to see what needs to be done, and maybe more importantly, what should be avoided. So discretion is the ability for a person to look at the situation and see. You could almost imagine an analogy of driving. You're on the highway and you sense there are cars backed up. Maybe you ought to take a side road instead. You're acting with prudence before you arrive at the situation, well in advance. You're marshaling your resources to figure out what should I be doing next so that you're not waiting too late to make a decision. So why introduce the idea of discretion at this stage? We opened with it, and here we are in chapter 5. There have been a lot of things said, and we're looking at this son's life and seeing Solomon's using his discretion, which is a wonderful picture within a picture. Solomon's using his discretion, and he's looking at the son's life, and he sees that there are changes coming in his son's life, and he wants to direct his son. He wants to, understand how to instruct his son so that he can act appropriately in the next stages of his life. And when he's looking at his son, he's seeing something. He's seeing this young man who's not as young as he once was, and he's not yet the man he will be, but he's in that stage of transition. And Solomon is very practically minded throughout the book of Proverbs. And one of the things he sees either happening or will be happening in his son is how his son will be developing strong sexual urges. That his biology is going to start taking over and representing a greater degree of influence in his life than it has earlier. Earlier, Solomon was laying out various plans, but in chapter 5, he's particularly focused on his son's biological urges toward a sexual encounter. And maybe his son's already at a stage where he's thinking about these things. Maybe it's something he's looking at in advance. But in either way, it would be naive to avoid discussing these topics, and it would be naive to avoid preparing our sons for the world that they will surely encounter. So Solomon's being very wise in how he's approaching what his son will face and what his son is thinking about. He's very practically minded. He's thinking, my son is going to be thinking of girls. He's going to be thinking of a sexual encounter with girls, and I need to make sure he's well prepared for that encounter. And in particular, he has in mind that his son is going to encounter somebody. There are two women portrayed in this chapter, not in the way Proverbs describes them in other places, but there are two distinct women in this chapter, and Solomon thinks it's prudent for his son to be thinking about both women. So the discussion is not for his son to stop thinking about women, but rather the discussion is think about women the right way. Think about how these desires you have can be utilized in the right way. And I think it's important to remember that it's entirely possible that the son will simply have a natural physical interest that can soon eclipse the interest of lending his ear to his father to understand. I've got other things on my mind, Dad. I'd really rather think about them than think about what you want to say about my life's course right now. So Solomon understands that young men need to be marshaled. They need to be ordered so that they can know how to live their lives in an honorable estate before God. And he wants to tackle this head on before Solomon loses focus on what's important in life. So now is the time to take these young men and impress upon them a truth while they are impressionable. I mean, it may sound painfully obvious, but it's not. You can't wait too late, and you certainly don't want to start too early. You want to strike while the metal is at precisely the right temperature, and what these men need is discretion. So starting in verse 3, Solomon is describing a woman that his son will surely encounter at some point, and he's effectively telling his son to consider this woman very carefully. Not carefully as a good prospect, but don't be fooled by her type of carefully. So in the previous chapter, Solomon ended with this discussion of using your whole body in the pursuit of wisdom, the eyes, the ears. And Solomon continues this idea of putting these very tangible images in his son's mind in order to convey truth to his son about the type of people he's going to encounter. So here he speaks of her lips, he speaks of her mouth, he speaks of her feet, and he speaks of her path, which is a very similar theme from what we just covered in chapter 4. The repetition is not accidental. It's meant for us to focus on it. Just as we are to consider our ways, we must also consider the ways of those with whom we might consider having a relationship with. We should be especially mindful of the ways of those individuals that we want to be intimate with. And I'm using intimate here in a broader sense and not limiting it to simply sexual relationships. So what do we see about this woman? Well, verse 3 tells us she's immoral, but that's not really the word underneath there. We encountered this word in another chapter, speaking also of an immoral woman. You guys remember what that word was that was used? It's a word that, what's that? Strange. Okay, I didn't see that. Yes, strange. She is a strange woman. And what's strange about her? Is she bizarre? Is she the bearded woman at the circus that you paid a nickel to see or whatever? Is that what makes her strange? Is she Mrs. McCready?
If she had a beard, she would be a grandpa.
If she had a beard, she would be a grandpa. That's right. Forgot about that. Now, what makes her strange?
She's unknown.
Not that she's unknown. Yeah, she's strange to you because she doesn't belong to you. She belongs to somebody else, presumably, but she doesn't belong to you. And that idea of ownership is very important in this chapter as well. This woman, she may be, in a previous lesson, we were looking at the woman who was committing adultery, right? She was forsaking the companion of her youth. And she was an adulteress. But here, there's no indication that she's an adulteress. She might be, but there's no indication. It could be she's simply a promiscuous woman. And the problem with her promiscuity is that she doesn't belong to me. Her sexual encounters are not my sexual encounters because we're lawfully married. She belongs to someone else, and she doesn't belong to me. That's what makes her strange. So, what is it of her behavior that will prove to be an enticement to this young man? And we see that in verse 3 that her lips drip honey and her mouth is smoother than oil. So I think we can contrast this description here with the earlier instruction that our lips should keep knowledge, right? Solomon's saying, your lips may keep knowledge. That's the purpose of learning discretion and for lending me your ear. For this woman over here, her lips are not used to keep instruction. Her lips, they drip honey. The idea behind this smooth talking woman, this smooth looking woman, is one translator likes the idea of she distills, that her lips distill these drops. It doesn't come out in a gush. Her words are smooth. They come in slow. And you've got to listen very carefully for what's happening or you're going to be deceived. There's a sense in which this woman is speaking pleasant things. That's the problem, is that it would be easier if she were strange and green, right? That would make it easy. We figure it out. We see her. But when Solomon looks at her, she doesn't look strange. She may not even be known to be strange at the time. And her lips speak pleasant things. I mean, this woman is smooth. And the whole idea of the pleasantness of words is a common theme. In Psalm 19:10, David describes God's law and the fear of God. And he says, this is sweeter also than honey, than the honeycomb. These words of God are sweet. And here, her words are sweet. Her words are something that are going to attract these young men. So, this is the woman who's going to say things which interest you. She is going to appeal to your interest. And I believe what Solomon has in mind is that she is alluring, she's crafty, she's flattering, she's seductive, and she's available. And Solomon doesn't deny her allure. He doesn't say, trust me, she's really not pretty. Or she can't hold a conversation. His description is, no, this woman is precisely what your body is telling you that you want right now. The appeal to the young man is that is very genuine. He's wired to be interested in what she's offering. But Solomon says something interesting in verse 4. He says, but in the end, she's as bitter as wormwood. So here we find that the father and the son are not looking at this woman the same way, are they? The son's looking at the woman. The father's looking at the end. There's a huge difference there. So the son can only see the girl. He can't see past her. Can't see through her. Do you remember the instruction from Proverbs 2, starting in verse 17? Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. This is an application of that. The son's looking at the bird. Or, well, in this case, he's not looking at the net. He's looking at the bait. So the son is being the dumb bird who's walking right into the net. The father can see these things. The father can see who this woman is and how this is going to turn out. And what is it that awaits the son? Well, bitterness and death are all that he has to look forward to in the end. The conclusion of your relationship will end in nothing but bitterness and death. The stakes are high. The stakes are permanent. And Solomon's description of her is, I think, very piercing and vivid. Her bitterness is like wormwood. Her life will cut like that of a two-edged sword. Her feet are on the path to hell because her steps grasp and seize hell itself. That's what this woman faces. She faces hell. She's looking at hell. She's going to hell. Right down to death itself. She's going to cut you 100 different ways. Her end is fixed, right? Her paths are already leading that way. Solomon is trying to help his son learn the difference between seeing the girl and seeing the end. You need to know how to look at girls. Now, that may sound like very strange advice to give a young man, but that's exactly the advice they need. They need help in learning how to look at the girls. And then in verse 6, there's some complexity to the translation of verse 6, but again, we have the idea of pondering, and I get the sense that what Solomon was communicating, that it's hard to communicate in English, is that this woman is not pondering her path of life because her ways are so unstable. And I think there's enough latitude to say, look at the end. I think that mixes well with what he was saying. Ponder her path, and you'll see that she's unstable and that this isn't going to end well. So I think in the end, Solomon is saying you need discretion and you need wisdom because you're going to fall in a trap otherwise. All right, so let's move on here to verse 7. This is the second section, and Solomon, again, I think only for the second time, and I think only twice, I may be wrong on that though, changes the address from my son to my children, or O ye sons, or O sons. So I don't know why. I don't think anybody really understands why. But he's painting a picture here of profound regret about the encounter that's going to take place between his son and this woman if he fails to lend his ear for understanding and to keep this knowledge and discretion. So back in Proverbs 4:14, Solomon made a very strong statement that his son should not enter the way of the wicked or the path of the wicked, and that merely entering the way was forsaking God's way. Because there was only one way that you should travel on for life, and there's one way for death. And you have to be on one of those paths. You can't go back and forth between the trails. What Solomon was saying in chapter 4 was, if you get off that one way, you're on the way of destruction. That's the end of the question. It's the end of the matter. And in verse 8, he's saying, remove your way far, far from her. You need to be on such a different path that nobody would ever think you're traveling together. In fact, don't even go near the door of her house. So he's thinking of this binary fashion of one path versus the other. So let me remind you, because Solomon likes to remind us, that merely entering the way of the wicked is a warning that you're forsaking the way of God. You don't have to be participating in their activities as they participate in them. in order to be on their path. The difference is in time. You simply haven't had enough time to start participating in their deeds of wickedness. But you will, because you're going to lose those temptations. So this warning is intensified with the imagery of not even going near the door of her house. All right, and starting in verse 9, we find a type of imagery which I thought was helpful, and that is one of escalating importance, escalating imagery. In verse 9, we see that when you start down this path, what's going to happen? You're going to give your honor to someone else. And in verse 9, your years are going to go to the cruel one, who is a savage messenger whose task is to bring you grievous tidings. So first your honor was gone, now your years, the years of your life are going to go to this cruel and savage messenger. And then in verse 10, aliens, strangers, are going to take your wealth. What you've worked your life for is going to be taken from you. And in verse 14, the foreigner is going to consume all of your labor. So when you look back at life and what you've done with your life, Solomon is saying that you start down this path, and increasingly, as you descend the path, will be the levels of judgment that you encounter. First, your honor, then your years, and then everything that you work for will be given to someone else. It'll be destroyed. You won't end up having these things. So the verses here between 9 and 10, and all four of these are joined together with these warnings and this conjunction, and lest you give your wealth to others and your years to the cruel one, lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. So finally in verse 10, in verse 11, we find another "and." And that's the end of the matter. And you mourn at last. So for his son, this is where it ends up. This is the mourning that will occur. Now, Solomon's flow of thought, I think, is beautiful. He sees the end in mind for his son as they're talking about these women, about this promiscuous woman. He sees the end. The son sees the girl. And he relates where her path is leading. He relates what's going to happen to him. And as he progresses down the path of this destruction, he ends it by saying, you're going to be mourning. And that mourning is not just a sadness. It has behind it the idea of the growling of a lion, of a loud noise. And I think the idea is tied back to the bitterness that he said she possessed. That when you realize what you've done, you are going to lament and you are going to growl. And you're going to be the one in the end that describes your life's path as how I have hated instruction and my heart has despised correction. So you see the path, you see the flow of what's taken place here. He's painted a picture. And Solomon does something very clever. He then changes the direction and said, let me talk to you about girls some more. Right? A guy might get pretty discouraged about that. Well, who's out there, Dad? What kind of girl can I expect to meet? And Solomon changes direction in a profound way. And I don't think this is a novel interpretation, but I do find it difficult to read through older literature because older sensibilities just wouldn't bring themselves to say these sorts of things. And modern writers don't seem to be as inhibited as some of the Victorian working assumptions. So I know you're thinking, what in the world is he going to say next? But I think it's important. So Solomon starts here. We're done with judgment. We're done. Now he tells his son that I really want to invoke your imagination a different way. I hope you were imagining all along the destruction this woman brings, but now I need you to use your imagination in a different way, and that is a way of blessing. And as we look through verses 15 and 16, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well, should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, we find that the metaphor being used is that of water. I mean, there are actually two different elements. There's water and then there's the containers of water. But I think the containers of water are there to simply describe for us what this water is meant to be like. So a cistern is awfully handy when you're in the desert, right? I mean, when you're in a dry... I had a cistern. It was a liability at some point. We got rid of our cistern. But in that part of the world, a good cistern's a good thing to have, right? But how... Where do you get water for a cistern? How do you get water in a cistern?
Drop from a well.
Not necessarily from a well. Often it's just filled with runoff, right? I mean, it comes off the roof or something, and you put it in a barrel. I mean, that's your little cistern. But people collect water through some runoff. But that's the extent of your water, right? I mean, if your cistern's this big, you can only have that much water. And so the metaphor here is that of water. Water is the thing you need to focus on. So drink water from your own cistern. Oh, scratch that. Running water from your own well. Now you've got a well that seems to have a spring attached to it. So it's filling even more and more. Oh, scratch that. I want you to imagine a fountain, which is a whole lot more than a natural spring, right? There's not much in the way of velocity with the movement of water. No. It's practically a river. It's a small river. It's a stream. There's streams of... You've got so much water, it flows in the streets. And he's particularly told to drink from his sources of water. And the idea, especially if you're living in a dry climate, everyone would know that having adequate supply of water would be a deeply satisfying experience, right? You're thirsty, and you've got water, and it feels really good. And Solomon is using this metaphor, this imagery of water, to describe the satisfaction that his son will have from the sexual encounters and the sexual relationship with this woman that he's about to describe here. So I think the idea of water and sexual satisfaction is something that is not terribly novel. In Proverbs 9 and verse 7, the adulteress there says that stolen water is sweet. She's describing her sexual encounters as that of stolen water. And in Song of Solomon 4:15, the bride is likened to a fountain of gardens and a well of living waters and streams of Lebanon. And if we take Solomon as the common author of these things, we're finding that Solomon is likening these sexual encounters to with that of water. So, in verse 17, he describes these waters as being your own. And that moves them out of the realm of being strange, right? That was the qualifier for the strange woman, that she doesn't belong to you. But he's saying that let them be your own. These are your waters. This is your water to enjoy. The stranger doesn't belong to you, but this water does belong to you. And then in verse 18, it's worded in a bit of a strange way. I can't quite decide whether Solomon is praying or whether he's pronouncing. It's not clear to me, except it might be a little of both. So this idea of blessed is very common. It's a common word in the Bible. God blessed Adam and Eve. He blessed the seventh day. He blessed Abraham. And it's an important concept in the Old Testament to participate in the blessing of God. And Solomon is saying, let your sexual encounters with this woman be blessed. Let your fountain be blessed. Now, I think the blessing includes things like children and relations with others and comfort, things that happen as a natural outworking of the family. But I think if we focus on those ideas, then we're forced to transition the metaphor right in the middle and say water up here means one thing and then water means something else. And I don't see how that's possible. It seems to me that part of the characteristic of this chapter is the escalating imagery. We mentioned earlier about the judgment. Well, here there's an escalating imagery in regard to happiness, of the joy of physical relationship with your wife. So you've got this well, which becomes a spring, and so forth, fountains and on. So, I don't know, is it a prayer, is it a pronouncement? It's not clear. But imagine being the son, having your dad talk to you about this, and what would your response be? You know, that my dad's profoundly interested in my happiness, and here he's seeking the blessing of God on my relationship with someone. And to isolate just this one area of your life, I think is remarkable. Perhaps you could paraphrase it as, look what God's offering you when you decide to walk in His way. See, before He was threatening the son with vivid imagery, and now He's trying to entice the son with vivid imagery that this is something you're really going to like, and it has the blessing of God on it. So, trying to decide what to cut here. All right, so let's move on. We'll just move on. Come back if we have time. In verse 19, there's a strange description. And guys, as you're courting a girl, I wouldn't recommend telling her that she looks like antelope, or that she's a loving deer. It depends, but I'm just saying. The commentator Zockler observes that these are fitly chosen images to illustrate the graceful, lively, fascinating nature of a young wife, which I thought was a good way to describe it. Obviously, that was a description of many years ago and how they would think about these relationships. This book was written in the ancient East. People were fond of these animals. The Song of Solomon has numerous references to them in chapter 2:9, 2:17, 7:3, and 8:14. All speak of this in terms of love. And then when you get down to verse 19, I think as this continues, or the second half of 19, as this continues, the singular idea that the metaphor that Solomon wants his son to understand is the physical sexual relationship with his son is a blessing of God. I think he describes it in reasonably explicit terms. The sexual relationship is great, and you can be completely satisfied with your wife's body and with her love. Young men need encouragement and instruction that sex is good, it's pleasurable, it's satisfying, but only when experienced within the confines of a one-man, one-woman, lifelong relationship of marriage. That's the ideal that Solomon has before his son. And he intensifies that by instructing his son to be enraptured with the physical love of his wife. Now, your translation may not see enraptured. It may read intoxicated, which is one of the ways that this word is translated. So, imagine trying to impress upon the son that the physical beauty of your wife is of such importance and will bring you such immense satisfaction in your life. It will be as if you're intoxicated. That's how happy you're going to be with her love. That's what God has in mind for him. So the underlying word here for this intoxicated and enraptured idea is to reel, is to not be in the way, but to reel. And in this picture, we have someone who is filled with delight, and not alcohol, he's not drunk, that he cannot even stand up or walk a straight line. He is so happy, physically happy, with the wife of his youth. But then in verse 20, Solomon puts a reminder back to what I've been describing earlier, son. Why, given the blessing that you've been told that you're going to get, that we prayed for, that we pronounced, why, given everything that God has in mind for you, would you ever want to be enraptured or intoxicated with a strange woman. In the arms of a seductress, you'll be reeling and not walking in a straight line. And again, the commentator Zockler describes this as the foolish delirium of the libertine hastening after the harlot. That's quite a contrast to the earlier idea of the lawful marriage bed, and the intense pleasure that comes with it, and being so ridiculously happy you couldn't walk a straight line, to this delirium you fall into as you're pursuing the harlot. So I think in summary of this section, I would describe it this way. It's the will of God for you to live with your wife joyfully, in bodily pleasure through an abundance of sexual encounters, in fascination and in happiness. You should learn to obey the commands of God and banish the thoughts of asceticism and abstinence. So that's my summary for that section. All right, we're not done yet. We've got a little bit more. We need to get through it. 21, 22, and 23. Never forget. For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all of his paths. God sees everything. And the idea of pondering is here again before us. And there's a little latitude in how to think about this word. Some liken it to making things level or even, and some liken it more to weighing, to determine something about it. I think the idea of making level is a clear picture for our mind. God is removing the obstructions that would somehow cloud his judgment. He's leveling things out before us so it can be seen perfectly. I mean, that's an image to help us. God doesn't need... Irregular terrain doesn't bother God. That's a metaphor for us to think about. And when somebody's weighing something, they're considering it in a very accurate way. They want to make sure they get it right. They don't want to be too much this way and too much that way. And I think the idea behind this is that God is seeing everything before us accurately, perfectly, as if it's all set out level before him. And in verses 22 and 23, we find another of these sets of escalating images. So here, the iniquities, this son's iniquities, what do? They entrap him, right? I mean, but entrapment's not the end, right? They entrap him. But then he's caught in the cords of his own sin. It was his sin which drove him into this trap. But first he was entrapped. Now he's caught in the cords. And finally, he dies. And why does he die? For lack of instruction. And that should bring us back to the earlier verse when the son mourns at last and says, "How I have died for lack of instruction." Solomon's saying, you pursue that strange woman, that's the path, this is what you'll do. Look at God's blessing. And if you don't heed this, you're going to be entrapped, you're going to be caught, then you're going to die, and in your bitterness, you're going to say, "It's all my fault. I hated wisdom. I hated instruction." In verse 23, we find that it was the greatness of his folly that helped this man to go astray. And do you remember how we should think about that word folly? It harkens back to Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but fools despise, right? Fools despise. What was the characteristic of the fool in his head? You guys remember what was the problem with the foolish head? You guys remember it was a characteristic about density. Do you remember density?
Remember what? Water.
Well, it's not filled. No, it's not filled with water. No, in fact, the fool's head is described as something so dense that nothing can get through to him. And the only thing he learns at the end of this chapter is that he hated wisdom and instruction. The whole lesson was lost on him. And he dies at the end because of this. And interesting, verse 23 here, that he shall go astray. That phrase is the same word that we used for the enraptured intoxicated. And it's used three different ways in this chapter. So Solomon initially sets out, I want you to be so happy physically with the wife of your youth that it's like you're intoxicated, you're reeling, you can't walk in the way, you're tipsy. And I don't want you to be in a state of delirium where you're pursuing the harlot, because then you won't be walking in the way either.
But in the end, if you don't do any of those things, you'll be like that intoxicated man who simply walks off the path. He doesn't stay on the path anymore. And that's the idea, is that the intoxicated one, the enraptured one, is unstable. He no longer can walk on the path. Think of it as a police check where they ask you to walk a straight line as evidence of you not being intoxicated. That's the idea here. And Solomon says there's a great way to be intoxicated. God wants you to be intoxicated in that way. And then there are ways He doesn't want you. And in the end, those ways are death. Well, there you go. Questions and comments. Silence wasn't what I anticipated.
Word picture for us to have, thinking about the waters, and maybe we don't.
Oh, I'm sure there is, but I wouldn't recommend people looking at it. Seriously, I wouldn't recommend guys looking at it. No, that's the problem. That's part of the problem. Guys look at the girls, and they don't look at everything else. That's the fundamental problem. No. No, this shows, I think, the brilliance of Solomon. I think it shows the brilliance of his poetry and how beautiful it is. No, I've thought about that, but no, I don't. Let's see. Yes?
Even in a land where we have tons of wonderful potable water, nobody lets their garden hose just run out in the street.
Right.
So they can pay a bigger water bill. Everybody recognizes how silly that is.
Yes, it is. That's right. Yes, Matthew.
I had a question about the two-edged sword.
Right.
I don't know all of my Bible where it's all mentioned, but it's mentioned in Hebrews, when I'm reading the Hebrews, about the word of God as a double-edged sword. Is there any other places in the Bible, or should I just go look it up?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think the imagery is not literally, if I remember correctly, it's not literally a two-edged sword, but it's maybe a mouth of swords.
In
Proverbs. I don't remember Hebrews. I didn't think about Hebrews at all.
Oh, I mean, Proverbs 5:4, where it says a two-edged sword.
Right. In Proverbs 5:4, I think it may mean literally a mouth of swords. That's what comes to mind, but I don't remember it. I decided not to spend much time on that image. Yeah, that's a good question. Jeff?
I was just curious if in all your studies for this book, ever come across anyone trying to reconcile the Solomon himself with this. Solomon married all these wives, so he deviated from the one woman. As a result, I may be reading between the lines, he didn't do a very good job educating his own children. Rehoboam was a fool. And the kingdom was taken away from him. It's not exactly the picture, but in a way, that's the water. The kingdom was taken away, the water was running out in the streets. And I've just, I've been reading Kings, First Kings recently, thinking about this, Solomon and all his wisdom, and we read this and then I think about how his life actually turned out and what happened from there. I don't know. Does anyone ever comment on it?
Oh, people comment on it all the time, and nobody has an answer for it. Who wrote Proverbs?
I understand.
That's the question you're asking, in a sense, is who wrote Proverbs? Was it the young Solomon or the old Solomon? And there's no clear answer. I haven't found it. And I find it remarkable when you look at images and metaphors and lessons to be learned, you think, wow, when did he see this? And did he decide to forsake it, or what did he do? I don't know. Nobody has an answer for it that I can tell. Dan?
I focused on a lot, but with her words being smoother, like honey and smooth.
Yeah. They drip like honey and smoother than oil.
There's other spots in Proverbs as well that talk about that same adjective is used for today. We still talk about a smooth talker. And all I'm noting, I'll have to think a lot more about this, is that Proverbs talk about the dense fool who doesn't get things, or not seeing toward the end of the matter. and so on. It's all wrapped up in this whole book. I'm struck by the danger of a person who is skillful with words. And I could be used for God's, I think, a very good preacher. It's a great thing to be very skillful with words, but the serpent, skillful with words, and we're all kind of familiar with this guy that we have in our mind, or here was the woman, the smooth talker. He's a deceiver, very skillful at using words in a way that's almost like magic for a person. Boy, he's got a dagger in his hand. So anyway, I'm just thinking through, and she can be the same way. Not just her physical beauty, but then
that's right.
Her words.
Yeah.
Very dangerous.
She's a complete package.
Yeah.
That's right.
All you see is, or just you're hearing what's on the surface, you do not understand what's going on, you're going to end up with a dagger in your heart.
That's right. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's close in prayer.